Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Schools in Dedham are closed today as hundreds of teachers are striking. The union, which is demanding better pay and that official language to address sexual harassment be added to the contract, authorized the strike after 21 months of failed negotiations. It is the first teacher strike in Massachusetts in 12 years. WBUR reporter Quincy Walters was at the strike this morning, and he joins us now. Quincy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So, Quincy, what's happening?
So, as you said at the top, teachers are on strike, and this has been something that's been boiling up for nearly 2 years. I talked to one teacher today who said she was kind of not expecting it when they announced they were going on strike last night, but she said this was a long time coming. There's been an impasse when it comes to compensation, when it comes to health care, when it comes to professional development and sexual harassment.
Okay, we said it's the first strike of teachers in Massachusetts in 12 years. Aren't they illegal in Massachusetts?
Yeah, so they are illegal. The State Department of Labor Relations issued an order telling the teachers to end the strike, but the teacher said they're prepared for fines and whatever consequences follow so that they can get a fair contract, which they've been waiting for 21 months. And the union overwhelmingly voted to go on strike. It was 275-2.
Did you get to talk to some teachers today?
I did. A few of them were reluctant, but I did speak to Brooke Peterson. She's been a teacher for 6 years at Dedham Middle School, and she told me one of the most important issues to her is getting a contract that has better protections against sexual harassment written into that contract.
This is a serious issue that many of us have unfortunately witnessed. I myself have been subjected to pretty foul language, and I've seen some of my coworkers have to file against this particular issue.
And Peterson said today she'd rather be in the classroom teaching her students, but she says that with the contract that they don't have, not being supported makes it hard for them to be in the classroom teaching those students.
Okay, well, she and her colleagues aren't in the classroom, which means no school. So what are parents and students saying?
Well, I spoke to a few students who admittedly are happy for the day off. And I talked to a parent who said that today she feels like her daughter is learning a valuable lesson. But Emma Jenniton is a fourth grader, and she was one of the kids who said she's happy to be on strike.
They help me and they teach me everything I need to learn.
And I talked to Joanne Scaramuzzo, who's the parent who said her daughter is learning a valuable lesson. She's a parent of three kids in the Dedham Public Schools. And she said she didn't mind her daughter Jill missing school today.
I think it's an opportunity, an educational opportunity for her at this stage to see how people come together, you know, the teachers, the community is supporting them when they really believe that something is, you know, right.
And Scaramuzzo says the teachers, you know, they do so much for the kids, and she just wants to make sure the teachers feel supported.
So that's a lot of pro-teacher message there.
Right.
What
right.
about from the administration?
Yeah, so ahead of the strike, Superintendent Michael Welch released a statement saying that they are saddened by this drastic measure that teachers have taken. He said they received the ruling from the Department of Labor Relations that says the strike is illegal and that the educator should return to work, but it was ultimately his decision to cancel school today, which he did. In statements leading up to the strike, the public schools contend that they did offer a pay increase for teachers and that they do have a sexual harassment policy in line with federal and state guidelines. Tim Dwyer, who heads the teachers union, says the caveat to their pay increases is that they'd have to spend more time in the classroom and that they'd end up having to pay more for their health insurance.
Okay, so this is the first day. What happens next?
So Tomorrow, they're going to be striking starting at noon, it seems. And it seems that they're reluctantly prepared to strike indefinitely. And, of course, they've been getting support from politicians like Representative Joe Kennedy III and even Bernie Sanders tweeting that he stands with the Dedham teachers.
All right. That is WBUR reporter Quincy Walters. Quincy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
Okay, it is Friday. We all know I love Friday because that means it's Week in Review. So let's do this thing. Our two panelists have been listening in the studio. With us first is John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and a blogger at It Is Good to Live in a Two-Daily Town. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
Okay, we've also got Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute with us. Jim, welcome back.
It's good to be with you.
All right, so let me just start. Both of you, first teacher strike in Massachusetts in 12 years, basically illegal. Your thoughts, Jim?
So my first thought is there's a sexual harassment issue. They should take care of that immediately without any connection to the rest of what's in front of them.
Because they being the administration.
The administration. I mean, there's no reason to hold up on anything related to that. And teachers do so much. But I would say that they're without a contract means they're under the previous contract. It's not like they're without a contract. And this is against the law, and they will be fined, sure. But I looked up salaries, average salaries, and how much folks are making there. And I'd say the idea that this is a social justice issue for me is a little bit over the top in the sense that the average teacher, at least the average teacher in Dedham, makes $82,000. Their health care plans are either 75% covered or up to 90% covered, depends. That's pretty good coverage for anyone in the private sector. The raises they're talking about are around 12% for folks who've been in the classroom for 12 years or more. And for people below that, there's a 4% increase that's been promised plus 9%. So it's not like I think I've seen this so many times. I mean, in my town of Brookline, I've seen this so many times up close, but as an observer seen around the state, what this is for me is really, look, there's an arbitration around the corner and they're setting themselves up before the arbitration. This will not go on ad infinitum. I believe it was scheduled for like 10, 11 days from now.
It's an early to mid-November.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is jockeying for position.
John, do you agree?
Well, the numbers are the numbers, so I'm not disputing that. I think there is an empowerment issue here that teachers here in Massachusetts and all over the country are trying to address with these strikes. There have been strikes in Kentucky, Arizona, Colorado, West Virginia. I mean, this is something that has sort of bubbled up in a way that it hasn't for a long time. I think it's the idea of empowerment. I think it's the idea of sort of being more in partnership than being management versus union. That said, there hasn't been a meeting between the school administration and the teachers since August. So you wonder if this is just frustration trying to get them off the dime.
Okay. I'd like to keep an eye on this in the future, but we have so much to sort of cover today. We snuck that one in because it was breaking news, but let's get into the meat of our Week in Review now. Student activists at Harvard are boycotting the Harvard Crimson, which is the university's student newspaper. The controversy comes from a story that the Crimson published about an anti-ICE protest that happened last month in September. As part of the story, the Crimson included interviews and the name of at least one self-acknowledged dreamer who participated. The Crimson also reached out to ICE for comment, and therein lies the rub. Critics say it was tantamount to tipping ICE off. Basically, you give them a heads up about the protest and draw attention to the students who are in the story. But the Crimson says we were following journalistic standards and ethics, seeking comment from the subject of a public demonstration. Interestingly, allies are lining up on both sides of this one, and even staffers at the Crimson are divided. Before I turn to the panelists, what do you think of this situation? What do you think? Did the Crimson put students at risk, or do journalistic ethics outweigh the concerns of students in this case? Are students taking the right approach to pushing back? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. John, you are WBUR's media analyst, so obviously kind of curious what you think.
Yeah. I thought you might be coming to me first.
So did Jim, by the way.
No, I was just going to turn to say, John's got that one.
One clarification. The Crimson did not contact ICE for comment until the protest was over.
Correct.
That's their policy.
That's correct. It was
That's
as they policy. Were writing the story afterwards.
So you can understand how fraught and sensitive a subject this would be for someone who is in the country, undocumented, going to school, or qualifies as a dreamer. On the other hand, this is the Umbridge Industrial Complex in full gear. This is not something where they endangered these students. One of the staffers on the Crimson, I think an associate editorial editor, outed herself to the Washington Post. I mean, this is not...
As
undocumented. So, you know, this is a complicated issue, but I think what a lot of people are ignoring is standard journalistic practice. And it's journalism 101 to go and try to get something from each side. That's a legitimate a function of journalism. I think that this is an overreaction because of the sensitivity of the issue. That said, you know, some of the critics point to a previous article where there was a protest against Amazon with an ICE connection. The Crimson contacted Amazon, did not contact ICE. That's not a reason to abandon. I mean, that's a mistake on their part, but that's not a reason to change policy, which is what this petition that students have developed is asking for. It's asking for a change in policy, an apology, and also they're boycotting. Nobody will, or a number of student organizations won't give interviews to the Crimson. I think that's sort of self-defeating.
What do you think, Jim? And as you think about that, would there be some threshold of government activity or ICE activity that would flip the switch on whether journalistic ethics trumped the contrary here?
So you're talking to someone who believes super strongly in free press and even some level of confrontation of free society. So I looked at this and I said, of course the Crimson had a right to do what it wanted to do. Of course the kids had a right to protest as much as they wanted to. I do think it's really good journalistic practice to wait until after the protest to actually contact folks for comments. You don't want to let them know that something's going to happen. So I think therein lies a great sort of bright red line to say, let's not cross that. Look, if ICE were crawling all over Harvard, I think we might be in a different situation. So I'd say that might be something where, you know, I guess one of the things that struck me about this is I think that folks who are protesting must think that ICE is dumb. I mean, if after a protest, you approach them for a comment, that's the thing that's going to tip them off to your status. You must think that they have no surveillance methodologies outside of that, which is just unbelievable. So I completely agree with what John said, but I probably even go a step further in the sense of saying, look, you have to be ready for this. If you're going to protest, protests are not free. And I'm not saying that you should expect ISIS knocking at your door. I think the Crimson behaved extremely well.
So, John, I can see you just want to jump in, so go for it.
Yeah, I'm curious, and I don't know the answer to this. I'm curious whether anybody was streaming this live on Facebook.
I have no idea.
Or some other tech platform, because that would be something that could tip ICE off, but not what the Crimson did.
So
I think that there's a difference there, and I think there's a sort of an overreaction in terms of students complaining that they had been doxxed by the Crimson, and doxing is of course, you know, revealing personal information, home address, social security number, things like that. I don't think that serves them well to overstate things in that way. I think they can legitimately protest, and I think they have legitimate concerns, but to overstate them really weakens their case, I think.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the Week in Review with us and let us know what you think about the pushback on the Harvard Crimson for seeking comments from ICE after the protest. Let me tell you what's niggling at this about me. And, of course, I'm a journalist, and my default position is towards journalism. Ethics, and that really hasn't moved. But the idea that we may have a government agency that is, in fact, practicing surveillance, and Jim, some campus activists allege in their petition that ICE has a long history of surveilling and retaliating against those who speak out against them. Were you to believe that that is, in fact, what your government does? And potentially, were you to believe that your government does that, let's say, extrajudiciously, were you to believe that, would you at some point have the right to claim that a government acting in bad faith causes conditions that trump the need to get their comment in a situation like this? And I welcome either of you on
that. Well, if ICE is surveilling the Harvard students, they don't need the Crimson to tip them off that something
kind
is going
Jim's
on.
Point from earlier.
Right? So there's that for sure. I think that if ICE is surveilling Harvard, that's a decent question, a legitimate question to ask them if they would respond to you. The fact that they didn't respond could be because it was short notice. I haven't seen any follow-up from the Crimson that later on ICE got a hold of us and gave us a comment. So I think an interview with ICE would be interesting to in terms of what kind of surveillance, if any, are you, engaged in at Harvard? I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to report, and maybe that would set some minds at ease.
Yeah, the thing I'd say is, look, we're mixing up political questions with the health of institutions that are civic institutions, and I think that if the politics go off the rails, then the way to address it is through politics, and that may be having to do it quietly and not exposing yourself or having friends do it quietly. It's never a perfect world, as we know, Tiziana. And the other thing is to go to the media and say they are going beyond their judicious, their legal authority, and explain that to folks in the media, rather than having the media actually curtail how they do their work, which has its bounds, has its practices, and have served us so well in this country.
So here's the other question that comes up, I think, in this situation. In the Boston Herald, Cambridge civil rights attorney Harvey Silverglate questioned the intelligence of students who criticized the paper, saying that this was, quote, shocking and depressing, end quote, they don't deserve to be at Harvard, end quote. Now, that's a little intense, but it does raise, is there a wider question of do we need to educate the public about journalistic ethics and journalistic integrity in this world of quote-unquote fake news all the time?
Well, the Crimson published a note to readers that basically tried to educate them, and it didn't really register or change anything with the people who were protesting. I think Harvey really ought to lighten up a little bit, because I think that he's overstating something as well. I think these students have legitimate concerns. If they're undocumented, they have serious legitimate concerns, and the way to help them figure out how to approach Harvard, how to approach journalism, how to approach their situation is not to mock them and demean them, is to try to understand where they're coming from. So this is just an ideological difference here in terms of what journalism is supposed to do.
Okay. We're going to turn to a dramatic scene in Washington this week. Republicans led by Florida Representative Matt Gaetz stormed a closed-door hearing on Wednesday, interrupting testimony and causing a five-hour delay.
We're going to go and see if we can get inside. So let's see if we can get in.
Democratic Representative Catherine Clark said the stunt was not only pointless, but actually created a security threat.
By storming in, bringing electronic devices, it caused the entire room and process to have to be shut down and swept once again.
Now, Congressman Gaetz says the GOP is standing up for due process.
We were the 300 standing in the breach to try to stop the radical left from storming over our democracy.
Democratic Congressman Stephen Lynch says GOP complaints about secrecy are unfounded.
There are 40 Republicans in the room. There's no secrecy here.
And that there's an obvious reason that these are closed-door hearings.
We're not going to let this president and these witnesses all know what the previous witness said so they can line up their stories. That's not how this works.
So, how does all this work, and where do the events of this week leave us? Still with me to try to sort this out here in Studio 3 is John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, thanks for sticking with us.
Always.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, thanks for sticking with us as
nice
well.
To be with you.
And you, don't forget we want to hear from you as part of our Week in Review. What do you make of the Republicans storming a secure closed-door hearing? Should the process be more public, or do we need to be more patient as the inquiry unfolds? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and you can join the conversation. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, John, let me start. What was your reaction to Republicans storming this meeting in this secure room this week?
Well, the GOP is 100% irony deficient, because basically, they did
some good lines today, John.
I try. Basically, right now, the Democrats are doing the same thing the Republicans did in 2012 in the Benghazi investigation. This is the investigative phase of this process. The whole idea that there should be due process and confront your accuser, that doesn't work in the investigative part of the process. It's like if a bank robber saying, I want to be in the room when the police interview the teller, you know, so that I can say, hey, I didn't say, give me all the money. I said, give me all the honey. It doesn't work that way. The Senate trial is where you get to confront the accusers.
Because it's the trial part, right?
That's the
this
trial
is
part.
More like
this
a grand jury part.
This is the indictment part. So that's one thing. Another thing is that they're trying to essentially delegitimize this process. They're calling it a sham process. They're calling it unconstitutional. There are no real rules for impeachment. There are practices that were put into place before. So one of the issues here is there wasn't a full vote of the House to open up an impeachment inquiry. There's no requirement for that. There was one with Richard Nixon. There was one with Bill Clinton. There doesn't have to be one. I mean, I think from an optics standpoint, the Democrats have, a little bit of a challenge there. But basically, Nancy Pelosi is trying to save some of her members from taking that vote because they're in districts that Trump won and they just took over from Republicans. So that's a lot of jockeying back and forth. But the whole idea of we are going to delegitimize this process so that people, whatever comes out, people think that it is basically a circus and nothing to take seriously. That's their approach because they can't defend the president. You look at what they're saying to the media. Nobody is defending what Donald Trump did.
Okay, so Jim Sturgis, there was a conservative commentator on NPR this morning. His name is Jonah Goldberg, and he actually made the comment, the argument John just made, that Republicans are going after process because on content they can't win. Here's how he characterized the Republican position.
I think the Republicans have legitimate complaints that on a scale of 1 to 10 are about a 4, maybe a 5, and they are claiming they are about a 50.
So there is clearly a lot of over-the-top going on all over the place. It's kind of a dumb question. Is it necessary? But how big a deal is it that we're making such a big deal and it's like explosion every day?
This is the world we live in D.C., is it not? The way I think about this is we see both parties sort of hurtling at each other in a wild game of chicken. And usually what happens where the smash up happens is institutionally in elections. And instead, what we might find, I think, over the next 6 months is that they don't realize it, but there's a cliff between them. There's this great crag, and they're going to fall both into the middle. I mean institutionally, not as parties. Mm-hmm. John did a very good job of describing why the Speaker of the House has chosen the path that she's chosen. And it is, in fact, true that there's no one impeachment process and all this. And frankly, all that stuff doesn't bother me that much. I think that from my perspective, there's no doubt in my mind that President Trump isn't presidential. And if people wanted to make a case for why he should be impeached, they could easily do it. But I guess what I'd say is they are doing exactly the same thing that Bill Barr did with the Mueller report, which is to keep it in secret to some degree and release things selectively. It's a release of selective things that I think is most bothersome to these folks. They don't really care about process. They know they're losing the political argument, right? That's what they really care about.
Right.
But you could point fingers at everybody and kind of say they're all doing these things. But I guess what I'd say overall is that you have the FBI, high officials in the FBI who are actually now under criminal investigation. There's just so much junk there that it is really deeply troubling to anybody who actually cares about institutions. Set aside the politics, frankly, that doesn't interest me very much.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. And we've got Margaret from Jamaica Plain on the line. Margaret, go ahead, join the conversation.
I think the Republicans are fabulous at publicity and public relations.
Margaret, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
You think they're fabulous at publicity and public relations? Why do you say that?
Because they're capturing the news cycle and complaining about a process that's already established. And people just turn that direction because it's the next shiny thing.
All right. Thanks for that call, Margaret. So how does one maintain long-term attention on a process with constitutional roots when there is a shiny new thing popping pretty much every 30 seconds?
Well, it's hard, obviously. And you know, in this phase, and by the way, speaking of the Department of Justice, you know, Congress, yeah. The House is now doing the job of the Department of Justice. This is what they should have done when the whistleblower came forward. They should have done this inquiry. So the House shouldn't have to go through all this. All of that material should be there. But it's not. So they're going through this process. By the middle of November, this is going to go public. And that's going to be the place where the process will be tested, whether the public accepts this as a legitimate inquiry and a legitimate investigation, and whether they accept the facts of the case. You know, right now, you have two parallel universes of information, and the information that's coming out from these interviews is tremendously damning. And whether the public will believe it or not is a good question. I mean, I think 34% of the public will not believe anything that's said. And there's a number of people who will believe a whole lot of what's said. And the people in the middle are going to decide whether this, you know, actually bears any fruit or not.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We want you in the conversation. And right now we want Jay from Newton in the conversation. Jay, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
No, I think the point, enjoying the discussion here, and I think the point as it relates to where the Republicans are coming from is that really most of the hearings that are being conducted are being, you know, conducted completely in secret. The only thing that the public is really hearing are selected leaks from these committees that aren't really that, you know, are where the people itself are not really getting the full perspective. And effectively, this whole process is geared to overturning the will of the people. And if you have this, you know, that going on, I think the people have a right to know what's actually being said.
Okay, great point, Jay. And I'm going to turn to Jim for that. So to the extent that, you know, however you feel about it, there are legitimacy concerns about this process. What needs to happen differently to begin to offset such legitimacy concerns?
I don't think that the Speaker of the House will do anything to offset them. I think that she will let the process go forward because, as John was explaining before, it puts at risk a number of seats that were won in the last election.
But is that a good enough explanation?
It is not. But this is all politics. And the politics may lead to truth. It has happened in the past. It has. So I'm not discounting them. I'm not saying by being politics. But I'm just trying to say that people want to actually work through this rationally. Throughout the last 3 years, I've consistently shut my mouth on this and just said, I'm going to sit back and watch because it's fireworks every single day. And it's really hard for me to actually see what are in the stars in the sky because the fireworks are everywhere.
Okay. We are going to turn to healthcare. But before we do, I want to give a couple of callers the last word. So, Tricia from Methuen, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I feel like the Republicans' behavior the other day was just an example of the buffoonery that is the Republican Party these days, ever since Trump took office. All standards, all decorum are out the window, and it's trickling down to the whole party.
Thanks for the call, Tricia. And let's add one more caller voice before we move subjects. We've got Bruce from Framingham. Bruce, go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I don't have a problem with the process, but I don't understand why it is not discussed analogous to a grand jury hearing where everything takes place in private. Testimony is given, and then the results of the grand jury are forwarded, and there's a decision as to whether to hold a trial or not. Why is it not presented that way by the Democrats?
Great. Great call, Bruce. And before I move on to health care, I will just say that on this show in the past, we've had former federal judge Nancy Gertner on, and she, in fact, has described it exactly that way, that what the House is doing is equivalent to some extent to a grand jury proceeding, and then what the Senate would do would be equivalent to a trial, and in that case, you'd have public release of information. All right, there's still more to get to, so I'm going to shift gears here. Callers, be ready to call in on health care now, because that's where I'm going to turn. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg were in New Hampshire today. WBUR's Anthony Brooks has been talking to voters in New Hampshire who, much like the Democratic Party itself, are split over the candidate's approach to health care.
I think he's right when he says people will have a choice and they'll make the best choice for themselves and we'll see what works best for everybody.
We'd be better off with a one insurance program for everyone because that way you spread the risk. But whether she can sell that or not, I don't know.
And we actually know that Warren has some selling to do. So, for example, a WBUR poll released this week found that Medicare for All Who Want It, which is the plan Pete Buttigieg has been putting forward, is the most popular proposal among Massachusetts Democratic primary voters, despite the fact that the candidate of choice is Elizabeth Warren. So, Jim, let's start there. If you watched any of the Democratic debates, you know a lot of talk about health care, certainly taking up a lot of oxygen in the race. Could that spell trouble for Warren, given what we know?
I think it could. And I think it's not what people point to. Everyone says, oh, it's because you don't know how, you don't have a plan to pay for it. I actually think the Americans, by and large, like to say they're for small government, like to spend big. So I think in if people thought they could get there, they might close their eyes and say, well, you know what? There might be some magic wand to get us there. I'm not saying that's reasonable, rational, or a good thing to do, but I think that's how they think. I think the problem for her lies in the fact that what people associate with healthcare is security. That is, they feel safe. They feel like they're not going to fall into this place where you might lose a loved one or you might yourself not be able to afford your coverage. So I think that's one of the selling points she has. But on the negative side, what she's doing is she's putting at risk all those people who actually have health care plans they actually really like. And we have a poll that's coming out in early November, just to sneak out one little bit of what's in the polling. 75% of employed individuals who have health insurance through their employers in Massachusetts, and that's a lot of Democrats, by the way, they really like their plan a lot. So that it's the disruption is more of a problem for her than I think the budgetary issues.
So, John Carroll, there's a long-term perception issue here. I remember in 2009, the famous town hall meeting in South Carolina where the person stood up and yelled, keep your government hands off my Medicare. When Anthony Brooks asked Elizabeth Warren whether she's pushing too far to the left on health care, here's what she said.
Look, I don't do polls, but I can tell you, we have a democracy that is broken right now. We have a country that works better and better and better for a thinner and thinner and thinner slice at the top. 2020 is our chance to turn that around, and that's what I'm in this fight for.
Is that message going to work?
Well, I think she's got one overriding problem here from a political standpoint, and that is Bernie Sanders. So she and Bernie Sanders are essentially proposing the same thing, Medicare for All. Bernie Sanders has come out and said, how do you pay for this? You tax people, but their costs go down. Elizabeth Warren is trying to get by just saying the second thing and not saying the first. And Bernie becomes a pretty inconvenient marker for her in terms of the politics of this. In terms of the sort of the fundamental desire of people for Medicare for All, the polls, the national polls are all over the place. You know, you can get them where they're overwhelmingly against it. 41% for, 56% against in a Wall Street Journal NBC poll. But then you've got another poll that has it 57 to 41. So, you know, it's really hard to gauge how the public feels. But you know that the public doesn't want to be finessed. They don't want to be sort of taken advantage of in terms of how this might happen. If they want to consider it, they should be able to consider it in all its details. And that's where Warren has fallen down, I think. She says she has a plan for how to finance it. She's coming out with it in the next couple of weeks. In the meantime, you know, she's dying, death by 1,000 paper cuts here, because basically everybody is talking about Warren's credibility now. In the beginning, it was likability. Then it became electability. Now it's credibility. Okay. And that's eroding her position right now.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Anne from Somerville, join the conversation. What's on your mind?
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yep.
I was just going to say that I'm a language student, and I would just say that the rhetoric the Democrats have persistently used on this is really ineffective. First of all, the term for all is a problem because it indicates people who aren't citizens benefiting from the system, and that's a political issue. Again, they only need to really appeal to voters. That's where they should be putting their political capital, the Democrats. The other one is that this is health insurance, not health care.
This is a shared risk pool. It is not just loading the system, you know, forcing taxpayers to pay for people who don't take care of themselves all at once. It's health insurance. And if you frame it that way, I know as an independent from speaking to crossover Republicans and fellow independents that Democrats could actually, you know, make a much more convincing argument. They just need to be more specific about their language.
So great call, Ann. Great. Thank you so much for that. And Jim, let me turn to you because, you know, that's a true independent voice saying, hey, let me tell you what you got to do to talk to me about this issue. Where are the key words and key concepts that all voters need and deserve to hear here?
It's a great question. She probably knows better than I do on that. I don't live in the land of polling too often. I guess the thing I'd say is that her point about health insurance not being health care is absolutely true. And in fact, if you take a look at Massachusetts, 97% of our residents here are covered in some way. But when you take a look at the state in terms of do they actually get care, it's very, very different, especially in the Cape and Western Mass. It's much harder. You may have paper Medicaid, but you to get and see a doctor is really, really tough. And I think
because of the supply of care itself.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing of it, the other part of this that no one really wants to talk to, look, for me, if I just flew in from nowhere and landed in Massachusetts and someone said, you get free care. And look, I lived abroad for 10, 11 years. It was that way in many of the different countries. And very often I ended up in a private setting because I didn't like the level of care I was getting. But the point I wanted to make is that if you flew in here and said you have care now, I'd say that's fantastic. The problem is over a number of years what happens. Medicaid and Medicare underpay compared to what the privates do. And as a result, the care is different. The doctors don't take it as often. And frankly, over time, it erodes the quality of care. There must be a solution to this. And frankly, it's not a totally free market solution. That's certainly not the case. But it's also not a Medicare for all from my perspective.
All right. So, John Carroll, let me give you last question on this. This, you know, sort of registers. We are in a healthcare-rich environment with a strong healthcare industry where healthcare employs a lot of people, and it's part of the brand of Massachusetts. Would Elizabeth Warren's plan starve the state she currently represents?
It could. I mean, if you're going to spread a finite number of resources out over a larger group, then it stands to reason that it might. A lot depends on how it's executed. The problem, I think, with this debate is it's way too complicated for a political campaign. Because what are you dealing with? You're dealing with 12 people on a stage, you know, trying to explain something that's incredibly complex. Or there's sending out ads on Facebook, or they're running 30-second TV spots trying to explain this. It simplifies it, and it distorts it in so many ways. So I think that this is not the venue, the vehicle for addressing something this complex. I think, in a way, you're better off looking at a candidate and say, who do I trust to fix this and take care of this if I put him or her in office? Because otherwise, this is just going to be a big tangle, and it's just going to be claim, counterclaim, and nobody's going to know which way is up.
All right, so I am calling an audible, because normally we'd be doing hubbubs right now, and they're usually my favorite thing. But I love callers, and the lines are completely full. So I'm going to give callers a chance to give their voices. We'll grab two or three of these right in a row. Bruce from Westboro, go ahead.
Hi. Anytime the subject of Medicare for All comes up, it's inevitably followed by, oh, you know, how are you going to pay for it? It'll be huge tax increases. Tell me what I'm missing. Back when I was working, my pay stub every week had a deduction for medical insurance that I was paying for my employer's group plan. And, you know, on top of that, my employer, I think, was probably paying three or four times that much, you know, that was coming out of my pay check. And I think that situation is representative of a lot of people.
Now, so give me the heart of the question, Bruce, so I can get another caller in, too.
If that same money went into the Medicare pot, I wouldn't know the difference. My employer's cost of payroll would be no different, and yet Medicare would be funded. So,
all right.
Why does that never come up?
Thanks for that point, Brutus. I want to take at least one more caller. Mary from Newton, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. So I think people worry a lot about whether Elizabeth and Bernie, whether it wouldn't get passed, just like you were just discussing. You bring them in, this is what they want to do, but it just doesn't really seem realistic.
You know, just not enough votes, Mary?
Right.
Okay. All right, thanks. No, I'm gonna let you go there. And so here's what I'm going to do. I've got time for one fast hubbub. I'd hate to leave him out. So, John, I'm picking you. What's your hubbub? It's got to be fast.
My hubbub is a mazel tov to the great Rafael Nadal, who got married this past Saturday.
I did not know.
Absolutely. On his native island of Mallorca, there were 350 people there. Roger Federer was not one of them, but the former king, Juan Carlos, was one of them. And I'll just give you one quick quote from Rafa. Obviously, I have the intention of planning a family. I love children, and I would like my children to do what they like.
Excellent.
A very Rafa-esque quote.
And I like Rafa, but not as much as Roger. Let me just be clear.
I have to go now.
All right. John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst and blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. It is always a pleasure.
Good to be with you. Have a great
weekend.
Regina, io vado a rubirti.
Soprano Amanda Forsyth. An internationally acclaimed opera singer, singing an aria from Mozart's Il Re Pastore. Forsyth is performing tonight with Boston Baroque, the orchestra that first gave her her start in early music. Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell spoke with Amanda Forsyth at her home in Belmont earlier this week.
I'm walking up to Amanda Forsyth's house. It's decked out in Halloween decorations in a quiet Belmont neighborhood. Quiet enough to hear her practicing from the sidewalk. Forsyth is now world famous, but at 22, she had just been rejected from a graduate opera program at NEC. Then one night, Boston Baroque director Martin Perlman was in the audience when she sang as a part of a student production. Impressed, he offered her an audition.
It felt huge. And I remember when he called me to offer it, I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm never going to have to audition for anything else ever again. My career is launched. And of course, it doesn't work that way. It was, you know, it's been a very steady climb for me. But having somebody hire you in a professional capacity gives other groups the confidence to hire you in a professional capacity.
Forsyth says, in this world, it is about experience, but also moments like these, where you just get lucky.
People don't consider luck as much as they should. It's incredibly difficult to break into this business, but also there's just so much competition and so many fantastic singers out there. It's really about being in the right place at the right time.
Since then, the right place and the right time has been all over the world. She's in her early 40s now, and she's been the star of opera productions in Rome, Geneva, London, Munich, and across the United States. But Forsyth loves being able to call Greater Boston home, because it's a hub for early music.
When I go to rehearsals, I sort of notice, yeah, I know every single person here. And I think it can be quite hard to break into that scene. However, there are so many different organizations here that if a singer is willing to start off in a chorus, a professional chorus, for example, like Boston Baroque or Handel and Haydn, often those groups will use those singers to start, you know, singing one-line roles, and then maybe they'll graduate to slightly bigger roles, and that can be a nice progression.
Early music is a broad term used for medieval, Renaissance, and even some Baroque and classical music. Orchestras like Boston Baroque play on period instruments or the instruments that would have been used when the music was first composed. When this type of music was first revived, Forsyth says performers stuck strictly to what was on the page.
People were relying more on treatises that they had read that said you should perform it a certain way. This trill should always start from above. This trill should always start from below. But now this generation feels much more confident with the rhetoric and the language of early music, that we feel we can take some liberties. We just feel free to do what sounds good in the moment. And I do think that audiences appreciate that.
What Forsyth loves about early music is the close collaboration.
With an early music orchestra, they're listening to hear what you do, and you could do something different every night, and they're going to copy you. So if you change one ornament and the oboe comes right after you, they're going to follow your ornament.
She has been rehearsing for her upcoming concert with Boston Baroque for their season opener, Mozart and Haydn.
Yeah, this was Bella mia fiamma by Mozart, and it has this crazy, which
which is quite difficult to sing. And it just gets worse and worse as he goes along. He does something like that. So.
The other pieces that we're doing an aria from Mozart's Il Re Pastore, which is incredibly beautiful and has a lot of these little minor chromaticisms that you hear them and you think, oh, this is Mozart. It has to be.
While this music is so intimate to Forsythe, she understands why some people feel like outsiders.
When I talk to people who have never been to an opera, a lot of times they feel like they don't know enough to go, that it's too foreign, they're not going to understand the language, too long, but it's more, it's like they feel, I don't know, they feel like they won't get it, so they don't want to try. And it's really difficult to convince them that you don't need to have a degree in music to go to a classical music concert. You can go and not know anything about the history of the piece or what was happening when it was being written and just close your eyes and enjoy the music.
But when her boys are in the audience, she makes sure they know the story. Her sons are 7 and 9, and they recently flew to see her in Handel's Semele in Philadelphia.
I explained the story to them ahead of time. I said, okay, mommy's going to be sexy mommy, and then I'm going to die. So not particularly child-friendly. And they came to some concerts this summer of a bunch of Handel cantatas based on powerful women. So I'm singing the role of Agrippina, and she's railing against her son Nero and wishing that he would die and that his bones could be scattered on the desert. And I look out at the audience and I see my little boys with wide eyes. I say, it's okay. Mommy's not going to kill you.
Soprano Amanda Forsythe. Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell spoke with her at her home in Belmont. Forsythe will be performing tonight and Sunday with Boston Baroque. More information is on our website, radioboston.org. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, and we had help today from Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.